We're talking about the crisis in finding affordable housing as we take a look inside America's big cities. On the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. House flipping, upscale neighborhood renovations, homeowners associations that insist on the status quo. We're looking at who gets to live in the nation's progressive big cities and who is excluded. And you're invited into the conversation at 800-642-1234. Has the high cost of living priced you out of a city? And if so, where did you go? Have you found yourself needing to move to a smaller community for cheaper living, even if it means a longer commute? What about affordable housing in cities? Have you tried to find it? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Randy Shaw is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. That's a housing provider for homeless single adults in San Francisco. He's the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. Randy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
You write early in the book that the unaffordability of desirable, high-employment cities basically defines urban America. Has it always been this way? What happened?
Well, it hasn't been this way. And really, always places like San Francisco and New York City, you've been expensive for a long time. But now you have places like Austin and Seattle and Portland and Minneapolis and Denver, and you go on all the cities, like including Oakland, which sort of led me to write the book, because the ghost ship fire December 2nd, 2016, 36 people die in a warehouse. And the question is, Oakland was always an affordable alternative to San Francisco, but now working and middle-class people can't even afford to live in Oakland. So there's definitely been a dramatic shift in who can live in our major cities since 2012, the second tech boom, so to speak.
And we're talking about both rent prices and housing prices, housing values, is that right?
That is correct, and they're both connected, and it's both, they describe in Generation Priced Out, it's both connected to a really artificially restricted supply over the last 30 to 40 years in all these cities, whereas population and jobs increased, nowhere near enough housing was built, so this is where we ended up.
Artificially restricted supply, where is that coming from?
Well, and this is one of the things I learned in writing the book, it comes because so many homeowner groups don't let apartments be built in their neighborhoods. I mean, in all the cities I just mentioned, in most of the cities, even in a city like San Francisco, which is known to be majority tenant, over half the city you cannot build an apartment. You can build a mansion, but you can't build a fourplex. Many of your listeners may recall that Minneapolis just passed something in December to stop single-family home exclusionary zoning, but that same process, that same law is applied to most of our major progressive cities, and it doesn't make any sense.
So you looked at San Francisco. You lived San Francisco. You are a housing activist in San Francisco. Where did that city go wrong? Because other big cities around the country say, oh, my gosh, we don't want to become the next San Francisco.
Right.
We don't want to become the next Manhattan. So what
right.
do you do to stop that slide?
Well, San Francisco has done a great job protecting tenants, a great job protecting its rental housing stock, and a terrible job of building housing. We build a few thousand units, but we add several thousand jobs. So when you're adding a population, our population has gone up 100,000 from the last census. We haven't added anywhere near that number of housing units just because, we have homeowners in the city who decide they just don't want anything built and they don't want apartments. It's zoned so apartments can't be built. So how do cities add to their housing supply when you can't build apartments?
But isn't this come down to policy decisions? How can homeowners have that much say on who gets to live in their neighborhoods?
Well, that's the problem, is politically politicians often defer to homeowners. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how many cities have local elections where the turnout is very low. They're off-year elections and homeowners disproportionately vote. Los Angeles just changed that. They're going through all elections on even-numbered years. So there's a lot of reasons, but what we have to do is get the mentality to realize that you can't battle climate change. And look what you're going through in Wisconsin now and with the impacts of climate change. When you're not allowing infill housing and you're forcing people to make hour-long drive commutes to work, which just spews greenhouse gases and the like. So there's a big environmental issue here as well. It needs to say, we have to override what these homeowner groups have been doing. And I talk in the book how the rise of the YIMBY, yes, in my backyard, the millennial YIMBYs have started to be a counterbalance to these homeowner groups.
We're looking at the housing crisis facing big cities today with soaring rents and housing prices. Randy Shaw is our guide. His book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. You have a voice at 800-642-1234. Is what we're talking here just the price you pay to live in a desirable urban area? Or do you think steps can be taken to make cities more equitable, more affordable? Bring your ideas, your housing reality at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Randy, as I read your book, I certainly thought about my upbringing in Minneapolis, within the city, and my parents who bought their home in the 1960s with a deed I still have in a box of $16,500. There were taxes on that to the tune of $10 something for some taxes. Late in the life, they had to sell that house because of aging, having that as the last equity. And when you put my address in Zillow and I watched that house change, that transaction happen, and my bungalow being bulldozed and now a McMansion is there, I start to wonder how any cities can stop this, because you put Zillow into that address and the astronomical difference between the magnitude of what that house was worth and then those transactions and the flipping that happened and the escalation there. How do you stop that?
Well, I think I described the generation price that cities like Seattle have seen a sharp decline in home prices and in rents after they went up, because so much supply comes on. You have to increase supply. You can't stop appreciation. But it used to be, if you were a teacher, the teachers in San Francisco were in their 50s, the boomer teachers, they could buy a house in San Francisco in the 70s and 80s and even in the early 90s. Today, a teacher can't even afford an apartment in San Francisco, and that's true for many cities. So there's been a definite shift in the population groups. The middle class that always was able to afford to find neighborhoods in these high, even the expensive cities, have been priced out because of it becomes a supply issue. And when you look at city after city, if in your parents' neighborhood in Minneapolis, if you can't build an apartment, and only single-family homes, and the prices become very high, and if there's a limited supply because nothing can be built, you're guaranteed to see the kind of meteoric rise in boomer homeowner values and millennials pay the price, because as boomers' homes go up and up and up, millennials are stuck having to pay the higher prices from the scarcity.
Well, let's look at millennials here for a moment. You talk about this NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Homeowners may not want that new apartment complex coming into their neighborhood, especially if they think it's going to drive down the value of their home, which they may have a lot of money invested in. So how do you...
Well, actually, what's interesting, I'm going to interrupt by just saying what's interesting, Kate, is that so many of the neighborhoods and all the cities I write about in the book, there were apartments built, and they exist. They're built in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, and they haven't decreased anyone's value. It wasn't until the 70s, 60s, and 70s that these neighborhoods, many of them passed these laws. Many of them had racial discriminatory laws. Once those were thrown out, they said, well, we'll keep renters out by only allowing single-family homes to get built. So a new form of exclusionary housing followed the ban on racial zoning.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Mark joining us from Madison. Hi, Mark. What's on your mind here?
One of the problems we had in a community south of Madison was that there was some problem areas, a lot of police calls, a lot of gangs in some of the apartment buildings, and they deteriorated to a point that they were taken down, and that didn't do anything for the housing. I understand the housing problem. We also do have some very good managed apartment complexes, and I think that's the key. To maintain the property values and the fear. It isn't always that it decreases the property value, but the fear of it is what people are afraid of.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because there was a whole big debate in Minneapolis, and many of you might have followed that, just, you know, where people were saying, wait, just because I'm a renter doesn't mean I'm bad for your neighborhood. And this idea that people who rent are somehow inferior residents and don't care enough, that's just not, the facts don't support that, and the facts also don't support declining values from having people who rent, particularly when they're renting a fourplex as opposed to a single-family home.
So where does gentrification come in? And is this basically what we're seeing, gentrification on a widespread, large scale here?
Well, see, this is the main point of what I say in my how my book, I think, differs from others, which sort of identify gentrification with building some large luxury project and it displaces adjacent owner or adjacent residents. But really, the major cause of gentrification of neighborhoods is just not building. And so with the price keeps going up because of scarcity. And that's what we've seen in San Francisco and Los Angeles neighborhoods. And then when in Los Angeles, I show how in one neighborhood gets gentrified, people who are priced out of that go to the next neighborhood. And neighborhoods like Highland Park and Boyle Heights in Los Angeles that no one dreamed would ever be gentrified either have been or already at risk. So by not building more housing and more affordable housing, everything becomes at risk.
We are looking at ways urban areas can help stop pricing people out of living in big cities and preserve economic and racial diversity. The book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? And author Randy Shaw stays with us. Consider this. Amazon alone added 35,000 jobs in Seattle from 2010 to 2017. And Randy Shaw writes, no city can build enough housing to avoid rising rents and home prices from such massive local job growth. So what's a city to do? 800-642-1234 is the number. Have you needed to move to a smaller city for less expensive living, even if it meant a long commute? Call in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this discussion in a minute on the Ideas Network. Talking about the high cost of housing in America's big cities and how working people are often priced out of living in many of the country's most desirable areas. It's a conversation you hear on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Piece in the New York Times caught my eye at the start of 2019. It had this headline, Happy New Year. May your city never become San Francisco, New York, or Seattle, or Portland, Denver, Boston, Dallas, Houston, or Los Angeles. So this urban policy reporter went on to write that San Francisco had come to stand for the worst set of horrors. It's the place where extreme poverty and tech wealth occupy the same block while school teachers and firefighters live 2 hours away. How do you counter this? What do you do? What policies do you put in place that promote racial and economic diversity? 800-642-1234. Randy Shaw is our guide here. His book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. Let's go back to the phones now with Chris joining us from Fitchburg. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Well, I have some news. Madison is definitely on this list of exclusive cities. excuse me. And also, it's not just true for millennials. I live on Social Security disability income and a tiny pension. I worked for 20-some years, and then a semi-truck slammed into me. But people on Social Security income in general, older people, and just lower income people in general, it's impossible to find housing here in Madison. I moved here in October last year, and had I not had a small, and I'm talking small, amount of savings, I would not have been approved for any apartment in the greater Madison area.
Chris, thank you for that call. Randy, what do you hear there?
Well, I think one important point that the caller makes is that the reality is my book is about people who have jobs, people who aren't eligible for federal housing assistance. But, you know, the big picture, 75% of eligible households in this country for federal housing assistance, because they don't earn enough money to afford rent, they don't get it, which is why we have a lot of people of all ages, either homeless or underhoused, And that's a federal issue. I'm talking about how cities can do more to house people who actually have jobs who aren't eligible. And the reason it tends to be more generational is that boomers are able to buy houses, and they didn't come out of college with $100,000 in debt like millennials now have to do. They were able to buy houses before the market went crazy, or get apartments before they went crazy. And Madison, to my understanding, is more expensive rent-wise than Chicago. So Madison is exactly the kind of city that I'm talking about in my book that needs to make sure they implement the kind of policies I recommend, a generation priced out.
Let's go to Jake now, joining us from Stevens Point. Jake, hi.
Yes, I just had a comment. My wife and I lived in Vancouver, Canada for a number of years, and we saw this firsthand. We were renting an 800-square-foot basement suite for in excess of $1,000, and part of what was driving their real estate market crazy was Chinese investment. And a lot of these properties were being built sort of for speculative investors and not actually being lived in. And I know as a city, they eventually got to the crux point where, once again, people were commuting in 2 or 3 hours. And I believe the city passed some legislation saying that, hey, you have to actually live in this residence for X number of months in order to be able to actually to own the residence.
The vacancy tax they passed, yes.
We actually moved from the West Coast back to Wisconsin. We were actually just floored at how cheap everything was.
And Jake, so you're in Stevens Point, which is a smaller community. How would you contrast that with West Coast or Vancouver?
I would say that our quality of life is better or identical. Our dollars definitely go a lot further. Granted, you're not going to have some of the amenities that we miss in the city, say, you know, really high-quality food, diversity, accessibility to the mountains, ocean, everything else. But long story short, I think our number one factor was obviously family.
So, Randy, there are trade-offs here.
The challenge is that the cities are the place where the high-paying jobs, educational, and cultural opportunities are. So often people don't have a choice to move to a more affordable city. That's the reason there's so much long commutes to the Bay Area in San Francisco, and why there's 120,000 people commuting to Sacramento, which is an hour and a half away, is people are living in the smaller cities so they can get affordable housing. But then the consequence for the environment and for their own lives is a very long commute. And that's sort of not what we really want in this era of climate change. And it's also not healthy for just people's family life to be away on the road so long. Yeah, many people are moving. That's why we have these long commutes, because they're following the exact route of your caller to move to a more affordable small city.
Let's pivot now to some solutions here that you see. You worked in this area a long time. What can be done, in your eyes, to ensure that affordable housing is built? We see the housing crunch. What do we do about it?
Well, every city that in America should make sure that apartments are legalized in all neighborhoods. You should be able to build a fourplex in every neighborhood instead of a mansion. And that seems sort of obvious. Mansions are not, there's no shortage of housing for wealthy people. They also need to build more affordable housing and protect their existing supply, because many cities still allow apartments to be demolished. I describe in my book how Austin, Texas, the owner decided they wanted to demolish a 240-unit apartment building housing loan for families. 6 months later, it was demolished. You can't lose your existing supply, and that just creates more displacement and the like. So there's many things cities could do to expand their supply, put housing bonds on the ballot to raise the money if the federal government or the state government isn't doing so. But it requires a sense of urgency. That's why I wrote Generation Priced Out. It's sort of a call to action to say something is very wrong when teachers, nurses, firefighters can no longer afford to live in the cities they work, and we have to start taking action.
What about protections for renters? How might that help?
I'm sorry?
What about protections for renters? That be of help?
No, and many in California, you can have rent control, and so many cities do, and San Francisco has the most extensive protection for renters of any city in the country. And other cities are often banned by their state governments from imposing protections for tenants. But clearly, you can't advance your city's economic and racial diversity if you're allowing people on 30 or 60 days notice just to be thrown out of their longtime home. So that's not an effective strategy, and it's not a moral strategy, and it's not one any progressive city should accept.
So Randy, can you give us an example of an American city that's getting it right?
Well, I would say that Seattle is doing the best. Seattle and Denver are both building enough housing. They're the Amazon problem was through Seattle out of balance temporarily. But what Seattle is also doing is protecting tenants by giving density bonuses so that developer can build two stories higher in exchange for protecting tenants and having their affordability. And I think that's a very good way for cities who can't do rent control to add housing and add affordable housing by increasing density. But as long as we only allow single-family homes, as long as we only allow duplexes, don't allow like fourplexes, eightplexes, 10-unit buildings to be built, we're never going to deal with the population increase that we're having as rents continue to go up. So everybody should be in favor of building more housing.
As we look to wrap up here, a lot of people may think, I'm just one person. What can I do? So what can individuals do here at a grassroots level if they're concerned about rising costs in their city?
That's a great question, Kate. I described in the book in city after city how individual people just started to take action to say, wait a second, we need to build more housing. And the homeowners are wrong. And we've seen city after city, I described in the book, from Cambridge to San Diego to, you know, all these cities that have not had a history of activism, people are getting active. It's making a difference. So I think people in Madison and in Milwaukee, people who are hearing this, should be getting involved because it makes a big difference when you get involved. And you can learn more about my book at generationpricedout.com and get all about all kinds of stuff. So people can take a look at that.
Randy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I hope you guys get some warmer weather ahead.
Thank you. Randy Shaw is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic, a housing provider for homeless single adults in San Francisco. He's the author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? Just ahead, coyotes don't just live in the wild. They're also showing up in urban areas and cities in Wisconsin. We'll hear a Wisconsin life story that takes us along with a group of scientists in the field studying the coyotes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. It is the Ideas Network.